This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Another day, another European leader wins a key vote and then maybe loses his job. The fate of Silvio Berlusconi today, and with it, perhaps the fate of the European debt crisis. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, everybody, the 8th of November. Good as always to have you with us. What seems to be happening in Europe, in Greece Friday and Italy today, is that prime ministers who've long since worn out their political welcomes win key votes and then lose their jobs all the same. Berlusconi did win a key budget vote in Italy today, but later said he might still resign. It's all a little tricky, which is why we put our European bureau chief, Stephen Beard, on a plane to Rome this morning. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So what is, this is going to sound like a basic question, what's happening?
Who knows, Kai? It's getting very complicated here. Various reports this evening say that Berlusconi has offered to resign as soon as he gets his austerity and economic reform measures through the parliament. It's not clear when that will be or whether Berlusconi is simply playing for time, because he suffered a very serious parliamentary setback today. He won his vote on the state budget, but it was a humiliating victory. He only won because the opposition abstained and he lost his overall majority. So he's very severely weakened, and the main opposition party have been threatening to have a vote of no confidence in him. So who knows whether Silvio is wriggling and trying to avoid the further ultimate humiliation of losing a vote of confidence in Parliament.
So let's play this out then. If he does resign once the austerity budget passes, can we then say, OK, the opposition is going to come in and get things taken care of and this crisis will be eased? Can we say that?
Well, financial markets, investors will be hoping that the opposition doesn't come in because the opposition is left of center. And investors fear that if they're running the government in this country, they may actually try to thwart these measures of austerity and economic reform. What seems to be most likely to happen in all this chaos and confusion is that if Berlusconi goes, what may follow him is a government of national unity, rather like the one they're trying to achieve in Greece at the moment. A government that could run things for about a year, put some of the reforms through, and then stand aside for a general election.
What do you suppose happens then, just to preview Bob Moon's story, which is coming up right after we get off the phone? What's going to happen in financial markets in Italy come tomorrow?
if the markets believe that Berlusconi is going, they will probably bounce. This has been the pattern of things. As soon as rumours emerged that Silvio was quitting, stock markets across Europe rallied. And then as soon as he quashed the rumours, they fell back again. Markets do believe that Silvio Berlusconi is part of the problem. However, there is also an economic and financial problem. Italy does have a huge amount of public debt. And investors and markets will not be happy until Italy takes decisive steps to get that debt under control.
Mm. Understanding that you've only been on the ground for 6 or 8 hours, Stephen, what are you hearing from regular Italians? And I imagine it's been cab drivers and hotel people so far for you.
Indeed. And this is before the news of Berlusconi's on-again, off-again resignation. They've been rather transfixed, actually, by the political drama, whether or when Berlusconi was going to fall. That's been the main preoccupation. But there is also a nagging sense among some of the people I've been talking to here that some pretty tough times could be on the way.
Stephen Beard in Rome for us. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Kai.
So here's the thing about the Italian debt crisis. It's not like nobody saw this coming. Rome's been running huge debts for years and handling it well enough. But much like a habitual credit card borrower who suddenly had his interest rate jacked up, it's the cost of that debt that's causing all the headaches now. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has that part of the story.
The irony is investors didn't seem overly alarmed when Italy's borrowing began to surpass its economic output a long time ago. So says economist Jacob Kierkegaard at Washington's Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Unlike other countries in the euro area, or the United States for that matter, Italy has actually had very high debt levels for decades.
What's behind that persistent borrowing? Kenneth Rogoff is an economist at Harvard University. He says Italians in the south have insisted on keeping up with their more well-to-do neighbors to the north.
Italy is a very divided country. The north is very productive and prosperous. The south, far less so. And the north makes massive transfers to the south. There's lots of government spending, lots of support programs, lots of versions of welfare. And it's expensive.
That was fine as long as growing confidence in Europe's financial union kept interest rates cheap. But now that's reversed into a vicious cycle. Investors are worried Italy could default, and they're forcing interest rates higher. Again, the Peterson Institute's Jacob Kierkegaard.
Italy was perfectly capable of financing its debt at, say, 4 or 5% interest rate. But now that we're close to 7%, it begins to become much more of a problem.
That would amount to a doubling of Italy's interest burden, and both Kierkegaard and Rogoff say that's unsustainable. It simply won't be able to pay. They remain confident, though, that a change of leadership could yet restore investor faith and bring Italy's interest rates back to more manageable levels. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Wall Street watched Europe with undisguised interest today, unseemly though it may be to profit from another's misfortune. No sooner had word spread that Berlusconi was on the ropes than the major indices turned positive. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The story of the moment out of Pennsylvania, of course, is the abuse scandal at Penn State and whether or not Joe Paterno is going to be allowed to finish out the season, his 46th. But as long as Paterno has lasted, this year's lasting story out of the Keystone State is economic. Harrisburg, the state capital, is in default. It owes bondholders and creditors more than $300 million. That is six times the city's annual budget. And how it got there is a convoluted tale of bad bets that the city's 48,000 residents are having to pay off. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale went up for a look-see.
Downtown Harrisburg sits on the eastern banks of the wide Susquehanna River in the center of Pennsylvania. The long riverfront offers all sorts of green space and recreation. In the leafy city neighborhoods, the houses are old and sturdy. People say life here is affordable.
I love this house. I still have my wedding decorations up. I can't bear to take them down. You know, we got married here.
Josie Vitale has lived in her renovated townhouse near the river for 7 years. A year ago, she landed a better job selling medical devices, but it's in Allentown, an hour and a half away. She put up a for sale sign in front of the townhouse, and it's still there.
Nobody wants to buy here. It's like this overwhelming feeling of uncertainty. You don't know what's going to happen.
She's about to take down the for sale sign and resign herself to the long-distance commute. It doesn't take long for conversations in Harrisburg to turn to concerns over crime and potholes. So far, the city isn't replacing retiring police and firefighters, and overtime and police training budgets took a hit this year. Last spring, a community group started foot patrols to try to cut down on muggings, robberies, and gangs. The city is overdue on some big payments to bondholders, and residents, who already pay about 18% of the property's value in taxes, worry those taxes will have to go up to foot the bill. Lunchtime at the Italian bistro Mangia Qui, in the shadow of Pennsylvania's 100-year-old Capitol building. So far, state workers keep the place busy, and the three owners just expanded. But now they worry about future business. Kwikwi Musara is partner and chef.
You can't just say, I'm done, I'm leaving, because there's nobody to pass it on to. It's like you're at the casino. You have to keep spending and betting on the gamble that one day it will turn back around. And it really should.
But right now, the city is broke and faces a state takeover of its finances. People here are afraid a state administrator would raise their taxes and sell the few assets the city has left, like parking lots and the incinerator, all to pay back the city's many creditors, who would be first in line. Stacy Basor, co-owner of the restaurant, says that's not fair.
It seems to me the state is working in the best interests of the bondholders, and it's a degree of corporate welfare. These people, too, should take a hit. They invested, they gambled. Obviously, they should have gotten their money back, but the bottom line is everyone is suffering, and you can't get, I'm not certain where else these funds are going to come from.
The other option is for the city to declare bankruptcy. A bankruptcy judge could forgive some of the city's debts and spread the pain among all stakeholders. Community groups are pushing that solution and are turning to the internet. Tara Leo Aki started a blog called Today's the Day Harrisburg.
It became a place where we post meetings, post information. It's a place where city residents can go and try to find out what's going on.
But even with the cyberspace support, blogger and concert promoter Mike Van Jura says it's getting harder to convince his audiences that Harrisburg is safe enough for nightlife.
All I want to do is run a fun, profitable business, have people want to come into the city and enjoy what we have to offer, not have to pay exorbitant tax rates, and be able to walk from my car to my house without worrying about being robbed. And that's not a lot to ask, not in the capital of Pennsylvania.
A federal judge will hear arguments on the city council's request for bankruptcy protection beginning November 23rd, and that's also the deadline for a state decision on taking over the city's finances. In Harrisburg, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The United Nations put the Syrian protests into distressing context today. The UN says 3,500 people have been killed there since March. It has been a year of change all across the Middle East, except for one small slice of the region. The six countries that are members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, are probably the best known. And yes, there have been some protests in those countries, but they haven't really gained any traction. And commentator Reza Aslan says to know why, all you got to do is follow the money.
The aging monarchs of the Gulf Cooperation Council, or GCC, have thus far managed to avoid the fate of Arab dictators in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya by essentially bribing their populations into submission. Saudi Arabia pumped $36 billion into its public sector, giving state employees pay raises and offering financial aid to students. Kuwait doled out $4,000 grants and free food rations to its citizens. Oman and Bahrain are using a $10 billion aid package to provide housing and employment opportunities for their restive populations. And even countries who want to become part of the GCC, Morocco and Jordan, have joined the spending spree. But these measures seem aimed simply at keeping the rulers in power. They have not addressed the very real grievances of the protesters: poverty, unemployment, government corruption, lack of political participation, all of the issues that led to the Arab Spring in the first place. In fact, these stopgap measures could spell further trouble for the countries of the GCC. Take Bahrain. The tiny island kingdom's increased spending in 2011 has put its 2012 budget shortfall at nearly $200 million. That might not seem a lot by U.S. standards, but it is 10% of Bahrain's gross domestic product. In any case, it's not as though the spending spree has stopped protests. Just recently, rallies were staged in Saudi Arabia's Qatif region against random imprisonments and political repression. That should serve as a reminder to us all that the young men and women who have sacrificed so much to challenge their repressive governments can't be so easily bought off. The Arab Spring is not just about fair wages and economic inequality. It is about something far more significant. It's about dignity and the desire to have a voice in one's government. And that is an aspiration that no amount of money can stifle.
Reza Aslan is the author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. Send us your thoughts. Marketplace.org is our website. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up.
Week after week, we go back to see how they're doing this week and what has changed.
It's like train wreck television. They want to see crashes.
No, not soap operas. It's political debates. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so the Dow Industrials rose 101.8% on the news out of Italy, closed at 12,170. The blue chips did. The Nasdaq grew 32 points, 1.2%, finished at 2727. The S&P 500 added 14 points, also 1.2%, closed at 1275. Investors seemed on board with Ford Motors' plan to fix its faulty dashboard computer. Share sped ahead nearly 3.5% today. Banks came out on top, too. Bank of America deposited 1.25%. Goldman Sachs added more than 2.8%. J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley both scored more than 2.25%. Elsewhere, shares of Activision Blizzard climbed 1.33%. The video game maker got a double shot of good news today. Quarterly earnings nearly tripled, and future profits look good with the release of its latest Call of Duty video game. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.08%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases data on wholesale inventories and sales for September. The Labor Department reports on extended mass layoffs for the third quarter. That's when 50 or more employees from a single company lose their jobs for at least 31 days. And a Senate subcommittee on privacy, technology, and the law discusses protecting health information in a digital world. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. According to the National Weather Service, the low temperature this morning in New York's Central Park, that's about as close as we could get to the Occupy Wall Street encampment downtown, was a relatively magnificent 54 degrees. Not bad for New York in November, right? That's nothing for a group that made it through the snowstorm a couple of weeks ago, but it is going to get colder, lots colder. So we sent Sally Herships out to find out how the 99% is going to winterize itself.
It's balmy today in Zuccotti Park, but with memories of that freak snowstorm still fresh, protesters are already preparing for winter. Kyle Kobe is an organizer there.
I honestly think it's going to thin out a little bit. I think there's going to be a lot of people who can't really handle it.
But they're trying. Urban campers are putting wooden pallets under their tents. It'll insulate them from the cold, wet winter ground. Some are even bringing in military-grade shelters. Lori Carnath, president of the Explorers Club, says nothing is more important than being prepared, which can mean different things to different people.
What you find in extreme conditions is that you spend a lot of time inside your tent, so good reading material is always important.
Some of the protesters' gear has come from Manhattan retailer Tents and Trails. Jamie Abish is one of the owners. Her advice?
Don't forget your hat, socks, and gloves. I personally like two layers, but if you're just standing around, protesting, I guess, one layer will be fine, a good thick pair of socks.
But winter weather gear can be pricey, so Abish says the protesters have been turning to plastic. Not their credit cards, but the material. buying lesser quality clothes and gear. She says it won't last, but shoppers are trying to be budget conscious and not just the 99 percenters.
The 1 percenters are just as careful about their money. That's why they're still 1 percenters.
Extra cash to keep you warm. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
One hesitates to pry, but here goes all the same. Why do you give to charity? Presumably, it's because you believe in the mission of the nonprofit in question. But does the tax deduction you get figure in at all? I ask because there's a move afoot in Washington to reduce that deduction, which brings us to our series Economy 4.0 and its examination of how to make the global economy work better for more people. It also, as it happens, brings us to our correspondent, David Brancaccio. Hey, David.
Hey there.
So you got to help me out, man. Why do people want to reduce incentives for giving, especially in times like these when, in theory, people need charities and what they do?
Well, number one, the government says it needs your money. Okay, there's that. And it's not just anybody saying this. The president of the United States is quite enamored with the notion of looking at this charitable deduction. Who is not enamored are Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill. They hate the idea. You can guess what charities think about this, and they're lobbying like mad to get the idea of reducing the charitable deduction off the table. But according to Suzanne Perry, who's senior editor at the Chronicle of Philanthropy, the president won't let the idea go.
People in the charitable world say, he was one of us. You know, he came out of a community organizing background. How could he do this? Doesn't he understand? But I think he is really convinced that this would be fairer.
It would be fairer to reduce the amount that you get back if you give to charity.
Well, so, David, what do we know behavioral economics-wise about what happens if you reduce incentives? Do people, in fact, give less money?
It looks like they do, but just a bit. There's a bunch of studies, and they don't all agree, but the estimate is last year we gave $290 billion to charity. Mm-hmm. If they messed with the charitable deduction, lose about $1 billion to $3.2 billion. But there's a different way of looking at it. Gene Sturley is a tax expert with the Urban Institute. He says the impact of tax incentives is an age-old question for economists. They don't agree on what will happen, as these reports showed. But maybe you could think about it differently.
Economists generally believe that to the extent you care about incentives, they apply more to the last dollar we give. So you and I are likely to give to our church or to some local charity, and we would do that whether we had a charitable deduction or not. But at the point in time in which we've already given that money away, our next dollars of giving are more sensitive, and we are sensitive to the extent to which there is an incentive.
So, David, riddle me this. Let's go back to the introduction when I said this series is about making the global economy work better for more people. What then can we say is the greater good? Collecting tax from people to use on, one imagines, government programs that help people, or encouraging people to give to charity?
Well, think of it this way. If the government can collect more taxes, there's more money for the government to distribute for services. But if the tax incentive does encourage, say, wealthy donors to give away money, there are studies that show that they tend to favor things like education rather than paying for basic needs, because that's what the donors want. So it actually changes where the money goes. Mm. What is interesting is that the bipartisan super committee looking at doing the big cuts to the federal budget, they're going to look at this. And when that report comes out later in the month, I'm going to look down to this charitable deductions line.
We'll see what it says. David Brancaccio in our series Economy 4.0. David, thanks a lot.
You bet.
The Republican presidential field schleps to Rochester, Michigan tomorrow for what feels like the umpteenth debate leading up to the primaries next year. And there will, of course, be more debates once the voting actually starts. Why so many? Because, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, people are watching. Or, more properly, they can't not watch.
Republican candidates agree on one thing. They want President Obama out. On pretty much everything else, they fight. Here's Texas Governor Rick Perry and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney.
Would you please wait? Working. Are you just going to keep talking?
They fight with moderators.
Hold on, let me finish.
There are rules here, sir.
They fight about fighting.
Debates have become reality TV.
Rita Kirk is a political consultant and professor at Southern Methodist University. As the campaign gets underway, political debates are becoming major events. They're unpredictable. They've got rowdy audiences and even rowdier candidates.
Week after week, we go back to see how they're doing this week and what has changed.
It's like train wreck television. They want to see crashes.
Larry Novenstern is with Orion Trading, an ad buying firm. He says those crashes are no accident. They're straight out of the reality show playbook.
Producers are using that script in their head to come up with the most inflammatory ways to get viewers.
And they're getting them. A recent debate on CNN brought in 10 times the viewers who typically show up for primetime cable news. As for revenue, Novenstern says a 30-second commercial during the debates might bring in 5 times the usual fee. Little wonder there are more than 20 debates on the calendar and more added all the time. Rita Kirk says that's quite the about face.
There was a time in our history when debates almost went away because people weren't watching them. And so literally it just almost faded from the landscape.
After all, many candidates were taking their cues from these two fellas.
The question before us is, which point of view and which party do we want to lead the United States?
Mr. Nixon, would you like to comment on that statement?
I have no comment.
When was the last time you heard that? I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, perhaps you've heard a giant asteroid is going to zip right by planet Earth tonight. Nothing bad's going to happen, probably, but it does give us an excuse to do this.
Get ready for an experience you normally only see in the movies. Live today.
What is this thing?
It's an asteroid, sir.
As big as an aircraft carrier. Asteroid 2005, YU-55.
It could be the end of the world as we know it. A massive asteroid on a collision course with our planet.
The voice of God right there? That was our very own Doug Krisner. Pretty good, wasn't it? All right, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 101 points, more than two-thirds of 1%. The NASDAQ up 32 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 added 14 points. Also, as it happens, 1.2%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time, back here, the first of a two-part series on the Chinese-U.S. education pipeline.
There's a lot of pressure on the agencies to write the application essays, to fake transcripts, to fake recommendation letters.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.